port side was a low, wide building with plain sandstone-colored walls. Buses of all kinds, not just Greyhounds, but Trailways, American Pathfinders, Eastern Highways, and Continental Expresses, ringed the terminal with their snouts pushed deep into the loading docks. To Rosie, they looked like fat chrome piglets nursing at an exceedingly ugly mother. She stood outside the main entrance, looking in. The terminal wasn't as crowded as she half hoped, safety in numbers, and half feared. After 14 years of seeing almost no one but her husband and the colleagues he sometimes brought home for a meal, she had developed more than a touch of agoraphobia. Probably because it was the middle of the week and shouting distance from the nearest holiday. Still, she guessed there must be a couple of hundred people in there, walking aimlessly around, sitting on the old-fashioned high-backed wooden benches, playing the video games, drinking coffee in the snack bar, or queuing for tickets. Small children hung onto their mother's hands, tilted their heads back, and bawled like lost calves at the faded logging mural on the ceiling. A loud speaker that echoed like the voice of God in a Cecil B. DeMille Bible epic announced destinations. Erie, Pennsylvania. Nashville, Tennessee. Jackson, Mississippi. Miami, Florida. The disembodied echoing voice pronounced it Miami. Denver, Colorado. Lady, a tired voice said. Hey, lady. A little help here, huh? A little help? What do you say? She turned her head and saw a young man with a pale face and a flood of dirty black hair, sitting with his back against one side of the terminal entrance. He was holding a cardboard sign in his lap. Homeless and have AIDS, it read. Please aid me. You got some spare change, don't you? Now help me out. You'll be riding in your speedboat on Saranac Lake long after I'm dead and gone. Now, what do you say? She felt suddenly strange and faint, on the edge of some mental and emotional overload. The terminal appeared to grow before her eyes until it was as large as a cathedral, and there was something horrifying about the tidal movements of the people in its aisles and alcoves. A man with a wrinkled, pulsing bag of flesh hanging from the side of his neck trudged past her with his head down, dragging a duffel bag after him by its string. The bag hissed like a snake as it slid along the dirty tile floor. A Mickey Mouse doll stuck out of the duffel's top, smiling blandly at her. The godlike announcer was telling the assembled travelers that the Trailways Express to Omaha would be departing gate 17 in 20 minutes. I can't do this, she thought suddenly. I can't live in this world. It isn't just not knowing where the tea bags and scrubbies are. The door he beat me behind was also the door that kept all this confusion and madness out. I can never go back through it again. For a moment, a startlingly vivid image from her childhood Sunday school class filled her mind. Adam and Eve, wearing fig leaves and identical expressions of shame and misery, walking barefoot down a stony path toward a bitter, sterile future. Behind them was the Garden of Eden, lush and filled with flowers. A winged angel stood before its closed gate, the sword in its hand glowing with terrible light. Don't you dare think of it that way, she cried suddenly, and the man sitting in the doorway recoiled so strongly that he almost dropped his sign. Don't you dare! Jesus, I'm sorry, the man with the sign said and rolled his eyes. Go on, if that's the way you feel. No, it wasn't you. I was thinking about my... The absurdity of what she was doing, trying to explain herself to a beggar sitting in the doorway of the bus terminal, came home to her then. She was still holding $2 in her hand, her change from the cabbie. She flung them into the cigar box beside the young man with the sign and fled into the portside terminal. Another young man, this one with a tiny Errol Flynn mustache and a handsome, unreliable face, had set up a game she recognized from TV shows as three-card Monty on top of his suitcase near the back of the terminal. Find the ace of spades, he invited. Find the ace of spades, lady? In her mind, she saw a fist floating toward her, saw a ring on the third finger, a ring with the words service, loyalty, and community engraved on it. No, thank you, she said. I never had a problem with that. His expression as she passed suggested he thought she had a few bats flying around loose in her belfry, but that was all right. He was not her problem. Neither was the man at the entrance who might or might not have AIDS, or the man with a bag of flesh hanging from his neck and the Mickey Mouse doll poking out of his duffel. Her problem was Rose Daniels. Check that, Rosie McClendon. And that was her only problem. She started down the center aisle, then stopped as she saw a trash barrel. A curt imperative, "Don't litter," was stenciled across its round green belly. She opened her purse, took out the ATM card, gazed down at it for a moment, then pushed it through the flap on top of the barrel. She hated to let it go, but at the same time she was relieved to see the last of it. If she kept it, using it again might become a temptation she couldn't resist. And Norman wasn't stupid. Brutal, yes. Stupid, no. If she gave him a way to trace her, he would. She would do well to keep that in mind. She took in a deep breath, held it for a second or two, then let it out and headed for the arrivals-departures monitors clustered at the center of the building. She didn't look back. If she had, she would have seen the young man with the Errol Flynn mustache already rummaging in the barrel, looking for whatever it was the ditzy lady in the sunglasses and bright red kerchief had 86'd. To the young man, it had looked like a credit card. Probably not, but you never knew stuff like that for sure unless you checked. And sometimes a person got lucky. Sometimes. Hell, often. They didn't call it the land of opportunity for nothing. The next large city to the west was only 250 miles away, and that felt too close. She decided on an even bigger one, 550 miles farther on. It was a lakeshore city like this one, but in the next time zone. There was a Continental Express headed there in half an hour. She went to the bank of ticket windows and got into line. Her heart was thumping hard in her chest and her mouth was dry. Just before the person in front of her finished his transaction and moved away from the window, she put the back of her hand to her mouth and stifled a burp that burned coming up and tasted of her morning coffee. "You don't dare use either version of your name here," she cautioned herself. "If they want a name, you have to give another one." "Help you, ma'am?" the clerk asked, looking at her over a pair of half-glasses perched precariously on the end of his nose. "Angela Flight," she said. It was the name of her best chum in junior high school and the last friend she had ever really made. At Aubreyville High School, Rosie had gone steady with the boy who had married her a week after her graduation, and they had formed a country of two, one whose borders were usually closed to tourists. "Beg your pardon, ma'am?" She realized she had named a person rather than a place, and how odd, this guy's probably looking at my wrists and neck trying to see if the straitjacket left any marks, it must have sounded. She blushed in confusion and embarrassment and made an effort to clutch at her thoughts to put them in some kind of order. "I'm sorry," she said, and a dismal premonition came to her. Whatever else the future might hold, that simple, rueful little phrase was going to follow her like a tin can tied to a stray dog's tail. There had been a closed door between her and most of the world for 14 years, and right now she felt like a terrified mouse who has misplaced its hole in the kitchen baseboard. The clerk was still looking at her, and the eyes above the amusing half-glasses were now rather impatient. "Can I help you or not, ma'am?"
"Yes, please. I want to buy a ticket on the 11:05 bus. Are there still some seats on that one?"
"Oh, I guess about 40. One way or round trip?"
"One way," she said,
and felt another flush warm her cheeks as the enormity of what she was saying came home to her. She tried to smile and said it again with a little more force. "One way, please." "That's $59.70, he said, and she felt her knees grow weak with relief. She had been expecting a much higher fare, had even been prepared for the possibility that he would ask for most of what she had.
"Thank you," she said,
and he must have heard the honest gratitude in her voice, because he looked up from the form he was drawing to him and smiled at her. The impatient, guarded look had left his eyes. "A pleasure," he said. "Luggage, ma'am?"
I don't have any luggage," she said, and was suddenly afraid of his gaze. She tried to think of an explanation. Surely it must sound suspicious to him, an unaccompanied woman headed for a far-off city with no luggage except her purse. But no explanation came. And she saw that was all right. He wasn't suspicious, wasn't even curious. He simply nodded and began to write up her ticket. She had a sudden and far from pleasant realization. She was no novelty at Portside. This man saw women like her all the time. Women hiding behind dark glasses, women buying tickets to different time zones, women who looked as if they had forgotten who they were somewhere along the way, and what they thought they were doing, and why. Rosie felt a profound sense of relief as the bus lumbered out of the Portside terminal on time, turned left, recrossed the Trunkatawny, and then got on I-78 heading west. As they passed the last of the three downtown exits, she saw the triangular glass-sided building that was the new police headquarters. It occurred to her that her husband might be behind one of those big windows right now, that he might even be looking out at this big, shiny bus beetling along the interstate. She closed her eyes and counted to 100. When she opened them again, the building was gone. Gone forever, she hoped. She had taken a seat three-quarters of the way back in the bus, and the diesel engine hummed steadily not far behind her. She closed her eyes again and rested the side of her face on the window. She would not sleep, she was too keyed up to sleep, but she could rest. She had an idea she was going to need all the rest she could get. She was still amazed at how suddenly this had happened, an event more like a heart attack or a stroke than a change of life. Change? That was putting it mildly. She hadn't just changed it, she had uprooted it, like a woman tearing an African violet out of its pot. Change of life, indeed. No, she would never sleep. Sleep was out of the question. And so thinking, she slipped not into sleep, but into that umbilical cord which connects sleeping and waking. Here she moved slowly back and forth like a bubble, faintly aware of the diesel engine's steady hum, the sound of the tires on the pavement, of a kid 4 or 5 rows up asking his mother when they were going to get to Aunt Norma's. But she was also aware that she had become untethered from herself, and that her mind had opened like a flower, a rose, of course, opened as it does only when one is in neither one place nor the other. I'm really Rosie. Carol King's voice singing Maurice Sendak's words, they came floating up the corridor she was in from some distant chamber, echoing, accompanied by the glassy, ghostly notes of a piano. And I'm Rosie Real. I'm going to sleep after all, she thought. I think I really am. Imagine that. You better believe me. I'm a great big deal. She was no longer in the gray corridor, but in some dark, open space. Her nose, her entire head, was filled with smells of summer, so sweet and so strong that they were almost overwhelming. Chief among them was the smell of honeysuckle, drifts of it. She could hear crickets, and when she looked up, she saw the polished bone face of the moon riding high overhead. Its white glow was everywhere, turning the mist rising from the tangled grasses around her bare legs to smoke. I'm really Rosie, and I'm Rosie Real. She raised her hands with the fingers splayed and the thumbs almost touching. She framed the moon like a picture, and as the night wind stroked her bare arms, she felt her heart first swell with happiness and then contract with fright. She sensed a dozing savagery in this place, as if there might be animals with big teeth loose in the perfumed undergrowth. Rose, come over here, sweetheart. I want to talk to you up close. She turned her head and saw his fist rushing out of the dark. Icy strokes of moonlight gleamed on the raised letters of his police academy ring. She saw the stressful grimace of his lips pull back in something like a smile, and jerked awake in her seat, gasping, her forehead damp with sweat. She must have been breathing hard for some time because her window was humid with her condensed breath, almost completely fogged in. She swiped a clear patch on the glass with the side of her hand and looked out. The city was almost gone now. They were passing an ex-urban litter of gas stations and fast food franchises, but behind them she could see stretches of open field. I've gotten away from him, she thought. No matter what happens to me now, I've gotten away from him. Even if I have to sleep in doorways or under bridges, I've gotten away from him. He'll never hit me again because I've gotten away from him. But she discovered she did not entirely believe it. He would be furious with her, and he would try to find her. She was sure of it. But how can he? I've covered my trail. I didn't even have to write down my old school chum's name in order to get my ticket. I threw away the bank card. That's the biggest thing. So how can he find me? She didn't know exactly, but finding people was what he did, and she would have to be very, very careful. I'm really rosy, and I'm rosy real. Yes, she supposed both sides of that were the truth, but she had never felt less like a great big deal in her whole life. What she felt like was a tiny speck of flotsam in the middle of a trackless ocean. The terror which had filled her near the end of her brief dream was still with her. But so were traces of the exhilaration and happiness, a sense of being, if not powerful, at least free. She leaned against the high-backed bus seat and watched the last of the fast food restaurants and muffler shops fall away. Now it was just the countryside, newly opened fields and belts of trees that were turning that fabulous cloudy green that belongs only to April. She watched them roll past with her hands clasped loosely in her lap and let the big silver bus take her on toward whatever lay ahead. Kindness of strangers. She had a great many bad moments during the first weeks of her new life, but even at what was very nearly the worst of them all, getting off the bus at 3 a.m. and entering a terminal 4 times the size of Portside, she did not regret her decision. She was, however, terrified. Rosie stood just inside the doorway of Gate 62, clutching her purse tightly in both hands, and looking around with wide eyes as people rushed past in riptides, some dragging suitcases, some balancing string-tied cardboard boxes on their shoulders, some with their arms around the shoulders of their girlfriends or the waists of their boyfriends. As she watched, a man sprinted toward a woman who had just gotten off Rosie's bus, seized her and spun her around so violently that her feet left the ground. The woman crowed with delight and terror, her cry as bright as a flash gun in the crowded, confused terminal. There was a bank of video games to Rosie's right, and although it was the darkest hour of the morning, kids, most with their baseball caps turned round backward and at least 80% of their hair buzzed off, were bellied up to all of them. "Try again, Space Cadet," the one nearest to Rosie invited in a grinding, inhuman voice. "Try again, Space Cadet. Try again, Space Cadet." She walked slowly past the video games and into the terminal, sure of only one thing. She didn't dare go out at this hour of the morning. She felt the chances were excellent that she would be raped, killed, and stuffed into the nearest garbage can if she did. She glanced left and saw a pair of uniformed policemen coming down the escalator from the upper level. One was twirling his nightstick in a complex pattern. The other was grinning in a hard, humorless way that made her think of a man 800 miles behind her. He grinned, but there was no grin in his constantly moving eyes. What if their job is to tour the place every hour or so and kick out everyone who doesn't have a ticket? What will you do then? She'd handle that if it came up. That was what she'd do. For the time being, she moved away from the escalator and toward an alcove where a dozen or so travelers were parked in hard plastic contour chairs. Small coin-op TVs were bolted to the arms of these chairs. Rosie kept an eye on the cops as she went and was relieved to see them move across the floor of the terminal and away from her. In 2.5 hours, 3 at the most, it would be daylight. After that, they could catch her and kick her out. Until then, she wanted to stay right here where there were lights and lots of people. She sat down in one of the TV chairs, Two seats away on her left, a girl wearing a faded denim jacket and holding a backpack on her lap was dozing. Her eyes rolled beneath her purple-tinted eyelids, and a long, silvery strand of saliva depended from her lower lip. Four words had been tattooed on the back of her right hand, straggling blue capitals that announced, "I love my honey." "Where's your honey now, sweetheart?" Rosie thought. She looked at the blank screen of the TV, then at the tiled wall on her right. Here, someone had scrawled the words, "Suck my AIDS-infected cock," in red magic marker. She looked away hastily, as if the words would burn her retinas if she looked at them too long, and gazed across the terminal. On the far wall was a huge lighted clock. It was 3:16 a.m. 2.5 more hours and I can leave, she thought, and began to wait them through. She'd had a cheeseburger and a lemonade when the bus made a rest stop around 6 o'clock the previous evening. Nothing since then, and she was hungry. She sat in the TV alcove until the hands of the big clock made it around to 4 a.m., then decided she'd better get a bite. She crossed to the small cafeteria near the ticket windows, stepping over several sleeping people on her way. Many of them had their arms curled protectively around bulging, tape-mended plastic garbage bags, and by the time Rosie got coffee and juice and a bowl of Special K, she understood that she had been needlessly worried about being kicked out by the cops. These sleepers weren't through travelers. They were homeless people camping out in the bus terminal. Rosie felt sorry for them, but she also felt perversely comforted. It was good to know that there would be a place for her tomorrow night, if she really needed one. And if he comes here to this city, where do you think he'll check first? What do you think will be his very first stop? Well, that was silly. He wasn't going to find her. There was absolutely no way he could find her. But the thought still sent a cold finger up her back, tracing the curve of her spine. The food made her feel better, stronger, and more awake. When she had finished, lingering over her coffee until she saw the Chicano busboy looking at her with unconcealed impatience, she started slowly back to the TV alcove. On the way, she caught sight of a blue and white circle over a booth near the rental car kiosks. The words bending their way around the circle's blue outer stripe were, "Traveler's Aid." And Rosie thought, not without a twinkle of humor, that if there had ever been a traveler in the history of the world who needed aid, it was her. She took a step toward the lighted circle. There was a man sitting inside the booth under it, she saw, a middle-aged guy with thinning hair and horn-rimmed glasses. He was reading a newspaper. She took another step in his direction, then stopped again. She wasn't really going over there, was she? What in God's name would she tell him? That she had left her husband? That she had gone with nothing but her purse, his ATM card, and the clothes she stood up in? Why not? Practical Sensible asked, and the total lack of sympathy in her voice struck Rosie like a slap. If you had the guts to leave him in the first place, don't you have the guts to own up to it? She didn't know if she did or not, but she knew that telling a stranger the central fact of her life at 4 o'clock in the morning would be very difficult. And probably he'd just tell me to get lost anyway. Probably his job is helping people to replace their lost tickets or making lost children announcements over the loudspeakers. But her feet started moving in the direction of the Traveler's Aid booth just the same, and she understood that she did mean to speak to the stranger with the thinning hair and the horn-rimmed glasses, and that she was going to do it for the simplest reason in the universe. She had no other choice. In the days ahead, she would probably have to tell a lot of people that she had left her husband, that she had lived in a daze behind a closed door for 14 years, that she had damned few life skills and no work skills at all, that she needed help, that she needed to depend on the kindness of strangers. But none of that is really my fault, is it? She thought. And her own calmness surprised her, almost stunned her. She came to the booth and put the hand not currently clutching the strap of her purse on the counter. She looked hopefully and fearfully down at the bent head of the man in the horn-rimmed glasses, looking at his brown, freckled skull through the strands of hair laid across it in neat, thin rows. She waited for him to look up, but he was absorbed in his paper, which was written in a foreign language that looked like either Greek or Russian. He carefully turned a page and frowned at a picture of two soccer players tussling over a ball. "Excuse me," she asked in a small voice, and the man in the booth raised his head. "Please let his eyes be kind," she thought suddenly. "Even if he can't do anything, please let his eyes be kind. And let them see me, me, the real person who is standing here with nothing but the strap of this Kmart purse to hold on to." And she saw his eyes were kind, weak and swimmy behind the thick lenses of his glasses, but kind. "I'm sorry, but can you help me?" she asked. The Traveler's Aid volunteer introduced himself as Peter Slowick, and he listened to Rosie's story in attentive silence. She told as much as she could, having already come to the conclusion that she could not depend on the kindness of strangers if she held what was true about her in reserve, out of either pride or shame. The only important thing she didn't tell him, because she couldn't think of a way to express it, was how unarmed she felt, how totally unprepared for the world. Until the last 18 hours or so, she'd had no conception of how much of the world she only knew from TV or from the daily paper her husband brought home. "I understand that you left on the spur of the moment," Mr. Slowick said. "But while you were riding the bus, did you have any ideas about what you would do or where you should go when you got here? Any ideas at all?"
"I thought I might be able to find a woman's hotel to start with," she said. "Are there still such places?"
"Yes, at least three that I know of, but the cheapest has rates that would probably leave you broke in a week. They're hotels for well-to-do ladies, for the most part, ladies who come to spend a week in the city, touring the shops, or visiting relatives who don't have room to put them up."
"Oh," she said. "Well, then, what about the YWCA?
Mr. Slowick shook his head. "They closed down the last of their boarding facilities in 1990. They were being overrun by crazy people and drug addicts." She felt a touch of panic, then made herself think of the people who slept here on the floor with their arms around their taped garbage bags of possessions. "There's always that," she thought.
"Do you have any ideas?" she asked.
He looked at her for a moment, tapping his lower lip with the barrel of a ballpoint pen, a plain-faced little man with watery eyes who had nevertheless seen her and spoken to her, who hadn't just told her to get lost.
"And, of course, he didn't tell me to lean forward so he could talk to me up close," she thought.
Slowick seemed to come to a decision. He opened his coat, an off-the-rack polyester that had seen better days, felt around in his inside pocket, and brought out a business card. On the side where his name and the Traveler's Aid logo were displayed, he carefully printed an address. Then he turned the card over and signed the blank side, writing in letters that struck her as comically large. His oversized signature made her think of something her American history teacher had told her class back in high school about why John Hancock had written his name in especially large letters on the Declaration of Independence. "So King George can read it without his spectacles," Hancock was supposed to have said. "Can you make out the address?" he asked, handing her the card.
"Yes," she said. 251 Durham Avenue.
"Good. Put the card in your purse and don't lose it. Someone will probably want to look at it when you get there. I'm sending you to a place called Daughters and Sisters. It's a shelter for battered women. Rather unique. Based on your story, I'd say you qualify."
"How long will they let me stay?"
He shrugged. "I believe that varies from case to case."
"So that's what I am now," she thought. "A case."
He seemed to read her thought because he smiled. There was nothing very lovely about the teeth the smile revealed, but it looked honest enough. He patted her hand. It was a quick touch, awkward and a bit timid. "If your husband beat you as badly as you say, Miss McClendon, you've bettered your situation wherever you end up."
"Yes," she said. "I think so, too.
And if all else fails, there's always the floor here, isn't there?" He looked taken aback. "Oh, I don't think it'll come to that."
"It might. It could."
She nodded at two of the homeless people sleeping side by side on their spread coats at the end of a bench. One of them had a dirty orange cap pulled down over his face to block out the relentless light. Slowick looked at them for a moment, then back at her. "It won't come to that," he repeated, this time sounding more sure of himself. "The city buses stop right outside the main doors. Turn to your left, and you'll see where. Various parts of the curb are painted to correspond with various bus routes. You want an orange line bus, so you'll stand on the orange part of the curb. Understand?"
"Yes."
"It costs a buck, and the driver will want exact change. He's apt to be impatient with you if you don't have it."
"I've got plenty of change."
"Good. Get off at the corner of Dearborn and Elk, then walk up Elk 2 blocks, or maybe it's 3. I can't remember for sure. Anyway, you'll come to Durham Avenue. You'll want to make a left. It's about 4 blocks up, but they're short blocks. A big white frame house. I'd tell you it looks like it needs to be repainted, but they might have gotten around to that by now. Can you remember all that?"
"Yes."
"One more thing. Stay in the bus terminal until it's daylight. Don't go out anywhere, not even to the city bus stop, until then."
"I wasn't planning to," she said.